You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Good afternoon, folks. Welcome to the Tom Hartmann Program, live from the nation's capital. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. I've worked in politics a really, really long time, in dog years, over a century. And that's not a pretty thing to think about. But you might remember me from Media Matters or campaigns, big and small. I'm a partner at Bullfight Strategies, a political consultancy here in Washington, and it's always a pleasure to fill in for Tom when he needs me. We're taking your calls, so please do give us a call, and we'll get right to it. You know, one thing that popped out at me as I was scrolling through Twitter, and you can follow me at Carl Frisch, that's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. One thing that popped out at me was Eric Fernstrom. You'll remember he is the Etch-a-Sketch coining spokesman for Mitt Romney. He was on Andrea Mitchell's show on MSNBC today, and he said that talking about Bain Capital was old news. Meanwhile, all the Romney campaign seems to want to do is talk about Bain Capital and the jobs that he supposedly created. You know, they used to say it was 100,000 jobs that Mitt Romney had created, and now they're saying it's thousands of jobs that he created. What's interesting beyond that is that anytime anybody brings up the fact that a lot of the time what happened was Mitt Romney and his friends at Bain would go in and take over these companies, load them up with debt, and then, you know, end up firing the people or the company going bankrupt. What they'll say is if those jobs ended up being lost after Mitt Romney left the company, they will say, well, Mitt Romney wasn't there when that happened. Even though he was part of the group of people that came in and took over the company and loaded it up with debt. Meanwhile, when they talk about the jobs that he created, there's no expiration date on those jobs. And nobody seems to want to give a straight answer on the jobs that were created. So it's certainly something worth following, and it's certainly something interesting. You know, it was if you want to know the kind of economic policies that Mitt Romney is going to pursue, you need look no further than the way that Paul Ryan, he's the author of something called The Hunger Games. I don't know if you've read, is it The Hunger Games that he wrote, or is it The Republican Budget? Or are they the same thing? Well, anyways, so he's written, once again, our version of austerity in the U.S., his budget plan. And here's what he has to say about Mitt Romney's budget. Let's hit clip two.
More to the point, though, the kind of budget that Mitt Romney's talking about is one to prevent a debt crisis.
I think we need to look no further. He's got a stamp of approval by Paul Ryan, of all people. And remember, Mitt Romney supports the Ryan budget. Now, when we talk about austerity, it's important to look at what's happening across Europe. You've had country after country where elections have just swept these austerity-pushing politicians out of office. And this is exactly what Paul Ryan is proposing. He wants to strip services for the people that need them the most, especially during times that are tough. He wants to end Medicare as we know it. He wants to privatize it and give it away to the corporate interests that fuel the Republican Party. He wants to take $800 billion out of Medicaid. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, on top of all that is the $1 trillion tax cut for the super wealthy. Because, you know, they've done really poorly these last few years. So we want to know what you think. Give us a call. Let's talk to Carl in Vernon Hills, Illinois. Hey, Carl.
Good afternoon. It's nice to talk to you. So I listen to your podcast all the time. It's kind of a different topic question. I hope you'll take it.
Sure.
My question is this. According to what Bernie Sanders said a long time ago, we loaned out $14 trillion to the banks, to governments, to everybody else. So we printed that money.
Right.
Now, when that money is paid back, why can't we use that instead of having Treasury bond sales and use it to reduce deficit below the debt ceiling?
Well, it's a good question. I think part of the problem is, frankly, that Republicans won't do anything that Democrats want to do to help things. Democrats have shown over and over and over again, to much dismay as far as I'm concerned, that they're willing to bend over backwards to work with their colleagues on the other side of the aisle. But, you know, you've got Speaker Boehner who cannot keep his caucus in order. I mean, listen to this clip of Speaker Boehner talking about what it's like to lead the Republicans.
But, you know, leaders need followers. Now, we've got 89 brand new members. We've got a pretty disparate caucus.
Some say they're leading you.
And it's hard to keep 218 frogs in a wheelbarrow long enough to get a bill passed.
I have never heard that turn of phrase used before. Certainly, it's like putting something in a barrel to be in the Republican Party or in a wheelbarrow. You know, I think it's probably manure and not frogs. But if you really think about the problem that John Boehner has had in his caucus, what he's done is he'll go and do negotiations with the White House and he'll commit to doing something. And then everybody agrees and he goes back to his caucus. And, you know, sure as the sun and the speaker are orange, he turns around and he rejects the deal that he just made with the president because he can't get his caucus to follow. So maybe it's not frogs that are in a wheelbarrow. Maybe it's lobsters. You know, that old, story about lobsters being cooked on a stove and they just can't escape because as one of them is getting up to get out of the pot, the one below it just pulls it on down. So I guess the things pulling it on down are lobsters that believe in birther stories, that the president's not an American, that he's raised taxes, he hasn't, and all the other baloney that these conservatives are believing today. Let's go to Bob in Brooklyn. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind? Bob? All right, it looks like we lost him. But we can always go to Linda in Tehachapi. Hey, Linda.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Really good. I love this show, and between you and Tom, always keep us well informed.
Well, it's certainly big shoes to fill, that's for sure.
Well, you know, you were talking about Romney and how he's talking about the jobs he created.
Right.
And on Sunday, I had the channel on a Weekend in Review with George Stephanopoulos.
Yeah.
Snuffleupagus. And there was a guest there. I actually wrote down what he said because I was shocked that he admitted this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who he was, but he was clearly a Romney supporter. And he says, there's nothing for Romney to be embarrassed about. He shouldn't be embarrassed about Bain Capital. They're in the business of making money, not jobs. And when you examine costs of a business, the biggest outlay is wages of employees. So that's where you cut if you want to make money and secure the interest of your investors.
Well, Linda, I think the clip you're talking about, and we have it here, is Jim Cramer. Let's hit Jim Cramer.
Romney's known as a job destroyer, not a creator. I just don't think that this will stick. I think Bain sticks. I think the idea that you bring in Bain, which is what happened in the 80s, they fire a lot of people, and that's how they get prosperity for the rich.
Finally, some honesty from Jim Cramer, of all people. That's what this is about. There's a reason that photo of Romney and his buddies holding up the money to show that they're there is what this is all about, and not about any jobs that would be created. The only reason that they would create jobs is if it would make them some money. That's why so many jobs were lost. But we want to talk to you about this. Give us a call, 866-745-2667, and we'll take your calls because this really is a big mess to get through if you think about it. You've got Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor holding the Republican caucus hostage, basically, without Speaker Boehner being able to do anything. And you've got Mitt Romney flopping all over the place to defend his record, which we're told was creating jobs and that it's old news. We'll settle that when we come back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, we'll tell you why Mitt Romney reminds me of Ross Perot's running mate. I'm not sure if that intro music is because Donna Summer died and we're celebrating disco, or because I'm what Newsbusters calls a gay activist, simply meaning I happen to be gay. So over at Newsbusters, they just decide anybody who's gay must be a gay activist. But I am one proudly. I didn't know it was part of my given name. So I wanted to play this clip for you. We played the clip earlier of Speaker Boehner talking about how his caucus reminded him of frogs in a wheelbarrow. You know, there are exterminators who can take care of bad frog problems. I'm thinking of Majority Leader Tom DeLay, for example. He used to be there in Congress. So if he's having problems, maybe he needs a majority leader like Tom DeLay and not somebody like Eric Cantor, although I quite like their infighting. I just wish that it would keep them from doing bad things. And that if there was less of it, maybe they would be working with us. Let's go to Bob in Brooklyn. Hey, Bob.
Oh, hi there, Carl.
Yes.
How are you? Thank you. I'm a Democrat. I'm involved in local Democratic Party politics over here. I don't like the Democrat strategy. I think you're going after Romney on his perceived strength as a business person. I don't think that's going to get it done. This is how I would wage the Democratic campaign. First, I would run on the Affordable Health Care Act, not run away from it. I think that's a positive issue. Now, here's another thing. There's actually two things, one about the budget, one about taxes. Now, yesterday, Paul Ryan was on TV.
He was on Meet the Press.
Right. This is about the third time in the past 6 months or so he has said he wants to raise taxes on people. Lindsey Graham twice said yesterday he wants to raise taxes on people. And John Kyle has said it.
Let's be clear. They mean poor people.
Right. Well, they talk about now they're slipping and sliding a little bit. They're kind of changing their rhetoric a little bit. They're not.
Well, when they say there are certain people who don't pay taxes in this country, they're not talking about rich people who can avoid taxes by legal loopholes. They're talking about poor people that don't pay an income tax, even though those people pay payroll tax.
Right. They're talking about, they used to say, broaden the tax base. In other words, eliminate a 10% tax bracket and raise it up to 20. They're changing a little bit on that. However, they're all saying, well, Lindsey Graham also said, eliminate all tax deductions. And they say all tax deductions are for the rich. No. Tax deductions right now,
sure.
If you have any out-of-pocket medical expenses yourself, it's all tax deductible on your federal return. Premiums on health insurance and your local property taxes, if you have state and city income taxes, all of that is tax deductible. That's on working class people.
Right.
And they would take that all
of
that.
Of course,
away from
they don't care about working class people. It's not a surprise.
The Democrats are not bringing this out. The Republicans are the tax raisers.
Well, I know that some Democrats are bringing it up, and we're trying to make sure that it's heard loud and proud on this show. Let's go to Will in Chicago. Hey, Will.
Hey, good afternoon. First of all, I just want to give you a warning. The running mate for Ross Perot, that gentleman was a war hero, an American hero. So
you can
compare Mitt Romney to anybody you want.
Let me just tell you why.
Okay.
This clip reminded me of Admiral Stockdale's opening in the vice presidential debates in 1992. Let's hit Romney talking about what he stands by.
I'm not familiar precisely with exactly what I said, but I stand by what I said, whatever it was. And with regards to, I'll go back and take a look at what was said there.
So that's what reminded me. I mean, you remember Stockdale getting up at the debate and saying,
I know, why am I here?
I
understand, but that man was an American hero. He served proudly,
I don't disagree with that at all. And I think that sometimes, hang on, Will, I think sometimes we are very thin-skinned as liberals, and we can take a little joking.
I know. The point I do want to call about those, we've got to call this whole vulture capitalism thing. We need to stop calling it vulture capitalism because it's not. It's vampire capitalism.
Oh, Will, but little girls love vampires.
Yeah.
You can't call it something that is, I mean, we can even call it zombie capitalism because people love zombies right now. Nobody likes a vulture.
We got to find something absolutely repulsive that everybody hates and call it that.
How about Republican capitalism?
Yeah, well, that makes me want to vomit. But unfortunately,
When you think about vampires, people think of Sookie and Bill, or those dreamy hunks on Vampire Diaries. They don't think about the vampires that we might have grown up with.
Yeah, no, I know. But, you know, the thing with Bain Capital is this is a company that goes out and takes advantages of companies, you know, whether they're struggling or not. But they have companies
right.
that they buy and dismantle and suck the life out of. You know, these aren't struggling companies. In a lot of cases, they just go in, they have the opportunity to buy out and then dismantle, firing people, laying off people, raiding the pension funds, and doing other things that are really immoral, if anything else.
Right. Well,
and
you know,
to simply say it's vulture capitalism, I think is nearly repulsive enough.
What they do is not just make money off the success of a company if it happens to be that way. You know, they come in, they make money, and then they make money on the company going under. It's sick if you think about it. It's absolutely sick. Let's go to Casey in Portland. Hey, Casey, what's going on?
Hi, pleasure to talk to you. You know, what slays me most of all is what the messaging that is not happening, both even at the elevator speech level, so to speak, and you know what I mean, since you're an activist.
Sure, the water cooler. Yeah,
even when you watch the pundits, and I was yelling at my TV set yesterday because I was watching Paul
if it
Ryan
answers
and
back,
Dick Durbin.
If your television
together.
Responds, make sure you get help.
What's
go
that?
Ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, and you know, Ryan was going, well, this president has done, the economy is stagnant. And Durbin should be saying, look, we have 4.2 million more jobs than when he came into office.
Right.
Bush was losing the jobs at a rate. He lost 2 million in the last quarter of 2008.
Right, he was losing 750,000 a month.
Exactly. And those points should be hit upon and then pivot immediately.
But Casey, we're not allowed to talk about the past. We're not allowed to talk about before Obama because everybody's got Bushnesia. Nobody remembers who it was before this president was in the White House or the problems he left us with. But I do, and we're going to talk about those problems when we come back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Are you suffering from Bushnesia? Tina Dupuy has the cure. Up next.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit carlfrisch.com for more information.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and that music you hear right there, that's my favorite, Ben Folds. You should go check him out, benfolds.com. He's reuniting with Ben Folds 5, and they're going to have a new album out soon. But enough about pop culture and music. I am joined now by one of my favorites, Tina Dupuy.
Smart, I want to bring on Tina Dupuy, managing editor of crooksandliars.com.
I'm a politician, which means I'm a crook and a liar.
Tina Dupuy is brilliant, she's funny, she's a terrific writer.
Tina does everything, and I just love her already.
Tina Dupuy, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm fantastic, Carl. Thanks for having me.
So one thing that I thought about, I had a caller on who obviously was suffering from a case of Bushnesia. The symptoms primarily being that nothing happened before the Obama administration. Is there a cure for Bushnesia?
Let me see. maybe a Jeb Bush administration.
Oh, wow.
I think that might be the only thing. I don't know.
I realize that you do cure a lot of diseases by playing with the genetics of the exact same disease. Like, you know, when you're bit by a rattlesnake, they use the venom. To cure you.
Well,
I don't think we should try that with our government.
Homeopathic remedies. You cure a burn with a hot compress. So, yes, the only cure for Bush is more Bush, which is why he is going to release a book, wait for it, on how to strengthen the economy, which I cannot stop laughing about.
Jeb is doing
that? He is qualified to write about how to strengthen the economy like an arsonist is qualified to hang drywall.
Jeb Bush is writing a Bush about the economy or George Bush is?
No, Bush, Georgie, W.
Wow.
It's going to be released in the fall, like just in time for the election. I mean, if there's nothing that's more of a where you can stick it to Romney, it's George Bush releasing another book.
Release the Kraken, as it were. Wow. So I just got my hands on a copy of George Bush's book in advance. For those watching at home on Free Speech TV, you just can't see it because it's invisible. But I'm opening it now as we speak. And it has a foreword by the smart one, Jeb Bush. Obviously, all humor aside, that sounds like the most ridiculous thing I've heard in weeks. And I cannot wait for somebody to ask Mitt Romney when he's read it.
Maybe he'll put it on top of his car.
Well, and,
he does have to think he likes.
You know, trees are just the right height. Unemployment lines are just the right length. I would imagine that George Bush's solution for the economy would not be that long. So there should be no excuse for Mitt Romney having not read it.
Right. It could be a picture book.
Now, since liberals aren't allowed to mention George W. Bush's name on television, radio, or in their writing, how do we refer to this book?
That's a really good question. We're going to have to use code.
Is it? Have you read this book by the president formerly known as?
Right. The problem formerly known as the president?
Yeah.
It's really tricky. I mean, really, everybody should be running the anti-George Bush campaign, but Romney seems to think that we really like guys who made a lot of money by firing people, and somehow that makes us think of job creation. The best thing about Romney recently is he's been accusing the president of character assassination, which would imply that Romney thinks he has character.
Right. It's interesting because, follow me on this, if you will, Mitt Romney's given birth name is Willard. Willard sounds like the name of the carnival owner in Scooby-Doo. So if you were to rip off Mitt Romney's face, I guarantee you George W. would be underneath it. Certainly his policies are the exact same.
Girl. I don't know if I can follow you.
His policies are the same, you know, and he would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for those darn kids.
I think you're on Scooby Snacks, bro.
Yeah, maybe. Speaking of Scooby Snacks, gay weddings.
Yes.
That was a weird transition. You have a great column out. People can find it at tinadupuy.com, titled Gay Marriage, The Republican Love Affair with the Past. They really are addicted to the idea that something was better back when.
Right. If we could just get back to how great we used to be, then everything will be better. Because, you know, and I point out in this column, you know, if you look to literature to tell anything about ourselves, which is really what it is, it's a reflection of how we think about the world, the future is always a dystopia. It's always going to suck in the future. And the past is always something to be nostalgic for. And to me, I'm not going to romanticize any time in the past before the advent of antibiotics. Like, I'm just not going to do it. But Romney specifically has been saying that he agrees with 3,000 years of marriage history. And it's
right,
like,
which is interesting.
Grandfathers were polygamous, which were not, you can do quick math.
I want to underscore what you just said there. But I want to play a clip of Mitt Romney. If we can play this clip again, we played it earlier in the show, but this just illustrates, if he can say that he supports 3,000 years of tradition, listen to him try to explain what he might have said in the past. Let's hit clip four again.
I'm not familiar precisely with exactly what I said, but I stand by what I said, whatever it was. And with regards to, I'll go back and take a look at what was said there.
So, he's obviously a man of candor.
Can we play clip number four again?
Let's play it again for Tina.
I'm not familiar precisely with exactly what I said, but I stand by what I said, whatever it was. And with regards to, I'll go back and take a look at what was said there.
It gets more and more painful every time I hear it. But here's what he was talking about, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, and the notion that he would agree with 3,000 years of history or so-called, you know, tradition with marriage, and not remember what he might have said about Jeremiah Wright. Here's my thinking on this. If he's going to talk about Jeremiah Wright, we get to talk about his religion. And, you know, just because we can't go in the temple to see what the bishops in his church are saying on any given Sunday doesn't mean we can't look at the history of his church or the history of his own family. I mean, you mentioned in your piece that, you know, he's not looking too far back on the tradition of marriage because his great-grandparents, tell us about what they did.
His great-grandfather left the U.S. because of polygamy laws, and so they fled to Mexico, and there's still a bunch of Romney cousins down in Mexico. Romney's father was born in this colony down there, and then once Mexico had a civil war, I think it was in like 1911, somewhere around there, the colony down there got a government bailout and came back to the U.S.
A U.S. government bailout?
You know, after Utah had stateship.
So his family returned to the United States because they were bailed out by the U.S. government.
That's right.
Be clear, the reason they went down there was because they were fleeing the United States because Mitt Romney's great-grandfather wasn't allowed to have multiple wives.
That's right. And so this was a religious freedom issue, to use a phrase that Romney likes to talk about when it comes to gay marriage. And they wanted to practice their religion freely, and so they went where there was less government to do that, which at the time was, well, probably in some places still
well,
is.
Well, you know, I think I might be on the Romney side here. I mean, if we're talking about 3,000 years of tradition in marriage, doesn't the idea of multiple wives and perhaps even hundreds of concubines go back much further than what we know of marriage today?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you want to talk about 3,000 years of marriage history, the Loving decision was in the 1960s, and that was that two people from different races couldn't get married. There were people until very recent history where you couldn't get a marriage license if you were not able to physically have children. So if you had any kind of disease or people who were there, the most famous case of this were Siamese twins, who could not get marriage licenses in many states because the state believed that was perverse.
The whole idea of them
having children was perverse. So, we have not had a consistent idea of what marriage is. And I read about in my piece, it was North Carolina who became the last state in the union to remove the marriage exemption for rape. So up until 1993, you could rape your wife all you wanted, and that was not illegal, which is a different interpretation in the last 20 years of what we think rape is. Or what we think marriage is.
One person's rape is another person's tradition?
Right.
Well, one thing that...
I mean, it's ridiculous to think that, like, we have some kind of Garden of Eden of marriage that has existed.
Garden of Eden is in Missouri, by the way.
It's just not true.
The Garden of Eden is in Missouri, which is interesting in itself.
You mispronounced that. It's Misery.
Misery, that's right. The Show Me State. Show me the Garden of Eden. Really? Come on. As if there was a Garden of Eden anyways. But
is this a real thing?
Yeah. So we've only got like less than a minute left before we go to the break.
I thought that was Dollywood.
Can you stick around?
Of course, for you, anything.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking to Tina Dupuy. We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-987-8466. That's 866-987-TOM. We're talking about marriage equality. We're talking about what it means to talk about Jeremiah Wright and the implications it has on Mitt Romney's own faith. And what exactly a tradition around marriage is in this country. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more with Tina Dupuy and marriage equality.
I need dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey, well, I need.
Welcome back.
Dollar,
this is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. We've been talking to Tina Dupuy about her great article, Gay Marriage, The Republican Love Affair with the Past. Tina, how many Republicans do you think are going to be swayed one way or another by the president's bold move to support marriage equality?
Well, I think now they have to be against gay marriage because he's for it. So if they were on the fence, they definitely have to be for it because that's kind of the Republican reaction. You know, if Obama's for eating vegetables, they have to be completely against that. You know, they just they're reactionary as a platform. But, you know, as I write in my article, this is really, and you know, they're trying to chum the water with something that's pretty anemic at this point. In 2004, this is something that would get ire up to go vote Republican, as we saw with Bush's reelection. But this is no longer something that really makes people upset enough to really be a winning issue for Republicans. The NAACP came out and said that they are
right.
for that this is a civil rights issue. The majority of Americans now, 51% by the last poll that I saw, agree with the president on this issue. And it's really going to be boring. One, it's just going to be like don't ask, don't tell, which, strangely enough, we no longer talk about.
Right, because my understanding is that our military did not disappear just by having gay people in it.
And no one's turned into a pillar of salt since sodomy was legalized.
Right, or before, frankly.
Right? So this is one of the things that's going to be, you know, in 5 years when this is all behind us and this is the resolved issue, no one's going to care. There's not going to be more marriages. There's not going to be more homosexuals. There's just going to be – it's going to be a very small minority, persecuted, ostracized minority of people who will see that they have more rights than they did before. And as Americans, we should always strive to have more rights and more human rights and more equality than we did before instead of less, instead of like finding a small group of people who are not able to defend themselves and go after them.
You know, one thing
that the Republicans have used as a strategy forever.
Right.
It's not single mothers, it's gays
sure.
or, you know,
but,
or
you know,
people who work
for
the government.
In this discussion over marriage, one of the things that occurs to me is our tradition of marriage in this country. Has constantly evolved, and we've talked a lot about this last year, about the war on women being waged by Republicans and conservatives. One of the things that's evolved with the institution of marriage is making women equal partners in those marriages. Because, you know, even if you only go back to our, you know, the idea of marriage between two people that might love each other only is about 200 years old. And frankly, a lot of the times in this country, even around our founding and into the early part of last century, you know, marriages were arranged, and women didn't have the right to leave an abusive husband. They didn't have the right to get out of a bad relationship. They didn't even have a right to enter into the relationships they wanted to enter into. And the idea that we would talk about the tradition of marriage being anything other than what we know it is today, a legal relationship between two people who love each other and want the same rights and responsibilities that go along with that relationship, is just sick.
Well, it's dubious and it's dishonest, and you're right. I have a medical dictionary from the 1800s, and they have two different kinds of cures for married women as opposed to single women. Single women implying that they are prostitutes, and married women were the only, you know, decent women in the world. Like, you had to get married. It wasn't just a choice. You were either mother or a whore, or a wife or a whore, and there was no other choice. And you know, and the medical treatments for the unmarried women were very much more, had more pain involved, and were more invasive and often humiliating compared to how you would treat a woman who was married who had the same disease. So I mean, we and you couldn't get a credit card in the 1960s. If you were not married, you would only have your husband's credit card. You could not, as a single woman, you know, businesses, banks would not give you something to in order to be independent. So the way we have thought about women and thought about marriage has evolved in the last, you know, 5 years, let alone the last 25. So you're absolutely right. Anybody who says that they agree with 3,000 years, and he also says sometimes 6,000 years. I don't even know where he gets these numbers, but you know, his
Missouri, actually. I think they're from Missouri.
Is to history, set to history revision. But there's no way to be able to say definitively that you agree with this, because it's just dishonest. The statement is absolutely, demonstrably false.
Well, demonstrably false never kept anybody away from making it, especially arguments on the right. I mean, they have a constant.
Right.
A belief that not only is the liberal media out to get them, there's a liberal media bias, but facts, numbers, shapes, letters, simple math, science, they all have a liberal bias.
Right. I recently went to the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee, and this was my favorite. There was a protest sign there that said, "Mixed racing is communism."
Well, I mean, today you could take that side and
in the same, like, you know, if healthcare is communism, if you like anything, it's definitely socialism. If Obama's for anything, even though the Heritage Foundation came up with the Affordable Care Act, then it's definitely socialism. And gay marriage will kill us all.
Well, you can go back in time to the 1950s and 60s, and just about every attack on integration or on mixed race marriages, those attacks are being made against gay people today. So
absolutely, any kind of progressive issue, any kind of social change they think that would give them an advantage, because sometimes it works. In 2004 is a really good example. Sometimes it works. Race baiting works. The Southern strategy clearly worked, and so they are kind of trying to. They have a one-hit wonder, and they're going to try and play it over and over again, hoping that it'll get the same result.
Well,
and this time, you know, I'm sorry, it seems pretty boring.
Well, and, you know, this is, it's funny. It's not surprising. I mean, this is a party that doesn't believe in evolution. But, you know, George W. Bush supported civil unions in 2004, and Mitt Romney doesn't support marriage equality or civil unions. He, frankly, doesn't even support domestic partnerships or legal contracts in many cases. So it's a massive step backwards. It's really quite sad. Tina Dupuy, managing editor of Crooks and Liars, I want to thank you for joining me today.
Carl, you're the best.
And you can find her on Twitter at Tina Dupuy or on the web at tinadupuy.com. We'll be back with more great Tom Hartman program after this.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, all afternoon. I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. You can follow me on Twitter as well, at Carl Frisch. We're taking your calls. Give us a ring, 1-866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Teddy in Long Island. Hey, Teddy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. So my question is, why does Romney and his constituents continually discuss President Obama's association? Why? Because they have no real substance against President Obama.
Right.
Why is it that the media doesn't discuss Romney's character, his high school bullying and cutting the hair of a student because he's gay? They, you know, and Romney poo-poos it like, you know, oh, that's during my immature high school days. But guess what? Most of
Romney, for some reason, is the only one that can't remember it. And you know what's interesting? This whole notion that President Obama did not get proper vetting in 2008 and that nobody heard about Reverend Wright is just such BS. And it's so categorically not true. And for Mitt Romney to claim, or anybody on the right to claim, that this is something that needs further investigation is just baloney. And every time they bring it up, we should be right there to remind them that in 1978, Mitt Romney's church finally let black people into heaven. So if they want to talk about Reverend Wright, we'll talk about Mitt Romney's faith. I don't think either have a place in the discussion, but if they want to play that game, we can play it too. Thanks for giving us a call. We are now joined by one of my favorites, Adam Green. He's a good friend of mine. He's also the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which you can find at boldprogressives.org. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Carl.
How are you? Are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay.
So what's going on up there in Massachusetts? We've got Elizabeth Warren, who's a phenomenal candidate, and she's facing off against Scott Brown, the original Tea Party candidate. And now I'm reading that Mitt Romney and Scott Brown are trying to distance themselves from each other.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's funny how in an election year, you know, Republicans who claim that we live in a center-right country do everything but right run on a center-right agenda. And now Scott Brown, who came to Washington to vote against millions of people having health care and having a public option, came to Washington to vote against or water down Wall Street reform, all of a sudden is pretending that he's not a Republican in the state of Massachusetts. And, you know, his election at the end of the day was kind of a fluke. He's not the real deal of anything. And Elizabeth Warren is the real deal. I mean, she is kind of the North Star for the Democratic Party at this point, showing Democrats across the country and across Massachusetts how to be an effective progressive campaigner on economic populism issues. We've seen candidates across the country emulate her boldness and her sense of principle. And that's why, just in a matter of months, she went from being 20 points behind Scott Brown to being in a neck-and-neck race. And my guess is that as Scott Brown continues to be a phony and distances himself from Governor Romney and from his own record, that Elizabeth Warren will soon have a much even bigger lead.
So my question is, why do you think it's so close given Scott Brown's record? Is it because people just don't know too much about it yet?
Yeah, you know, I think that Elizabeth Warren, you know, for those of us who have been following politics for a long time, we are aware of her record of really being one of the only.
Well, and we should be clear that most people do not follow the news or these candidates too terribly closely. I mean, remember, most people don't know who their own member of Congress is. So we're a unique bunch, and most people don't plug into the race until maybe a couple months before.
Right, a couple of months before, some a couple of weeks before.
Right.
And, you know, so those of us who, you know, listen to Tom Hartman every day, listen to you on a multitude of shows, who are on the boldprogressives.org email list, you know, we know that Elizabeth Warren has been one of the true public leaders who, when push comes to shove, has been willing to hold Wall Street execs to the fire and really grill them and hold them accountable. And that's amazingly popular in this country, even with Republican voters, let alone Democrats and independents. But people in Massachusetts are, you know, just gradually getting to know her. I think, again, it is quite significant that just in a couple of months, she would gain about 20 points in the polls. And nobody, you know, that we talked to half a year ago or so, 9 months ago, thought that Scott Brown was in any danger whatsoever. So the fact that she is forcing him to actually, you know, run for his political life and ultimately, you know, will defeat him is pretty amazing.
Well, and so, you know, it shows the stark difference between the candidates. If nothing shows the difference, I think the debacle at J.P. Morgan Chase, where they gambled with billions of dollars and lost it, is a perfect example of the difference between the candidates. You've got Scott Brown, who's busy chasing after J.P. Morgan Chase's money, for lack of a better word, to fill his campaign coffers. And you've got Elizabeth Warren, whose mission in life this past decade has been to right these wrongs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this episode has really, I think, allowed Elizabeth Warren to, you know, hit her stride in the middle of, you know, kind of a dead part of the normal election year. And I think she showed how powerful it will be to have someone like her in the Senate at a moment like this. I mean, she, from like almost hour number one, was talking about this issue. She gave a major speech just hours after this news was announced and talked about how Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan need to be held accountable. She was, you know, I think the next day out there calling for Jamie Dimon to resign his seat on the New York Fed, which is supposed to regulate New York banks.
Right.
And then she joined us in launching a national campaign to have more Wall Street reform, including a new Glass-Steagall Act to separate risky investment practices like what J.P. Morgan does from traditional banks where everyday people put their life savings.
Right. They're gambling with our money, and that's the big sticking point here.
Right. Gambling with our money, and then if they win, they win. If they lose, taxpayers have to bail them out.
Well, let's be clear. If they win, they win. It's not like they're giving us dividends when they gamble with our money.
Yeah, exactly. She's really, let's just finish the point. I mean, she has really seized this moment, has driven days and days of national news on this. And again, that's what the Democratic Party needs at this point. Honestly, we haven't really seen that from the White House. We've seen a president who called Jamie Dimon one of the best within this week after this news was announced and kind of made the somewhat weak case that, oh, even one of the best would have this foible and therefore we need more regulation. No, Jamie Dimon is not one of the best. He is a, you know, somewhat corrupt Wall Street actor, not a corrupt maybe in, you know, the harshest sense of the word, but he is a product of a corrupt system. He is one of the main people pushing for more deregulation of Wall Street. And he has proven through all this that he is not the most competent manager of billions and billions of dollars. He wasn't even aware of the unit that was doing this stuff.
And I think that's the big difference, right? I mean, what's the $1 billion here or there between billionaires?
Right. Right. I mean, that's a very capitalist attitude among some people. But again, Elizabeth Warren, just to get back to your point, you know, really kind of sees this moment, and it's kind of inspiring to see, you know, what a Democratic politician can do.
I am getting breaking news out of the Scott Brown headquarters, and I'd love to discuss it with you after this break, that Scott Brown is now saying definitively that Jamie Dimon should have to wait before he's seated at fancy restaurants an extra 5 minutes because of his actions here. So
that's called accountability.
Adam, can you stick around? I want to talk to you about these other races across the country.
Sure.
All right. We're talking to Adam Green. He's the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which you can find at boldprogressives.org. You can also find them on Twitter at boldprogressives. We want to hear what you think about the race in Massachusetts, but also across the country, where bold progressive candidates are taking to the streets and working to make their way to Washington so that they can hold some folks accountable. The president can't lead on these issues if there aren't people in Washington who have his back. That's why we need somebody like Elizabeth Warren and Tammy Baldwin up in Wisconsin and Eric Rego in New Mexico. And we'll talk about those races and more when we come back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, we'll talk about sending more bold progressives to Washington. Stick around. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in all afternoon for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Of course, you can always find me on Twitter as well, Carl Frisch. We're getting conflicting reports from the field now, whether or not George Bush's yet-to-be-released book coming out this fall on how to fix the economy is or is not a coloring book. As soon as we get clarification on that, we will get right back to you with the fact of the matter. We've been talking to Adam Green. He's the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee about the Senate race with Elizabeth Warren up in Massachusetts. But there are a lot of great, bold, progressive candidates running across the country, and I want to thank Adam for sticking around to talk about that with us.
Yep, good to still be here, Carl.
So take us through some of these races. Out in New Mexico, for example, where you've got Eric Riego, who I've talked to on this program before about his race. What's going on out there?
Yeah, well, June 5th is turning into Super Tuesday of sorts, and Eric Riego is one of the bold, progressive candidates who is in a competitive primary against more conservative opponents. Eric is the real deal. He is one of the most progressive elected officials in New Mexico, a state senator, a former city council member. In both of those cases, he won his seats by defeating more right-wing incumbents who were Democrats, people who would associate with the group ALEC, for instance. You know, people kind of who were Democrats in name only. He ran principled campaigns and defeated them. And now, you know, kind of following the lead of Elizabeth Warren, he is making Wall Street reform and Wall Street accountability a centerpiece of his campaign. And in fact, just last week, he launched a new TV ad, which is the first TV ad in the entire nation to be run by a congressional candidate that actively calls for Wall Street bankers who broke the law to go to jail.
And that you know, what's fascinating to me about that is that it shouldn't have been the first ad.
Yeah, you're right. It shouldn't have been the first ad. And, you know, it shouldn't be seen as that bold.
Right.
You know, I did it.
In fact, we shouldn't even have to talk about it because people should have stood trial for the wrongs that they committed.
Right. But, you know, I and, you know, all of us at the Progressive Change Campaign Committee are viewing this election as really a multi-billion dollar conversation with voters. Right. We need to use this conversation to actually, you know, put things on the agenda, put things into the conversation that will set the stage for smart policies down the road. And if Eric Riego wins his primary on June 5th after running this ad, my guess is that there will be copycat ads across the nation, which is great. There will be a spirit.
Hopefully there's some copycat legislation in Congress.
And ultimately that, or the Department of Justice seeing, oh, it's actually okay to challenge these bankers more. Let's start some real prosecutions.
Well, hopefully it puts a a terror into the banksters who have just run roughshod over working people in this country. What else is happening out there? I mean, if somebody wants to, how can they get involved in Eric's campaign?
Yeah, so, you know, we have links to all of our endorsed candidates at our website, boldprogressives.org, and Eric, I believe, is gregoforcongress.com.
So going across the country, where else do we have great opportunities? I mean, one of my favorites is Tammy Baldwin up in Wisconsin, but I know that there are a lot of other candidates too.
Yeah, there are a number of good candidates. So another piece of Super Tuesday, June 5th, is a hotly contested primary in California's 52nd district around San Diego. I'm actually going to be there tomorrow doing an event with my co-founder Stephanie Taylor and with Howard Dean.
Well, and you know, for those listening at home that don't know this, Adam and I live two blocks from each other in Washington, D.C., where it is currently foggy and raining, and he's telling me that he's going to be in San Diego tomorrow.
Sorry, Carl.
At least it's for a good cause. So who are the candidates there?
So we have Lori Saldana, who is a three-term progressive legislator in California, a great record of fighting for a multitude of things that we would all support, you know, fighting
right
against proposed cuts to schools, fighting for nurses.
And she's truly grassroots, too. I met her when she was running for the assembly for the first time, and yeah, she, by walking door-to-door, beat somebody who spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's not close to $1 million. And I think in the primary, she spent tens of thousands of dollars that first time around.
Yeah, no, that's her, one of her claims to fame, is really being in touch with local people, going door-to-door, and, you know, earning her seat by being in touch not with big corporate contributors, but with the people who she actually would represent.
Right.
Now, in this campaign, she is up against kind of the polar opposite. She's up against a self-funder who calls himself a Democrat, but on literally day one of his campaign was on TV and was posed the question, would you cut entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid? And he said, quote, yeah.
Sounds a little bit like Mitt Romney.
Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, the fact that this would be the Democratic nominee and that somebody would be in a Democratic primary taking this message to voters is just appalling. And meanwhile, Lori is promising, like Eric Grego, no cuts to Social Security and Medicare. Instead, let's tax the rich. Let's hold Wall Street accountable. So, you know, if these two bold progressives win on June 5th, that will really send an important signal, have important ripple effects around the entire nation. At the end of the day, these will be competitive
bellwethers, really.
Yeah, they're bellwethers. And for those of us who care about having the Democratic Party be progressive, you know, we want national party money to be going towards progressives, not conservatives, right?
Right.
And part of the way to do that is to win these primaries, because Lori is running in a district against a Republican incumbent who was just redistricted and put in a much more Democratic district.
Well, and, you know, he's almost lost the last several cycles, and he's in even a more Democratic district now.
Exactly. So, you know, the Democratic Party will be there for whoever the candidate is, and the question is, will they be there for a candidate who wants to cut Social Security and Medicare, or somebody who will be a reliable ally, not just saying no to those cuts, but also actually helping us to push the ball forward on things like government investment and jobs?
I couldn't agree more. Adam Green, co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, thanks for joining me today.
Yep, thanks,
Carl. Find out more about these candidates and all the work that they do over there. Go to boldprogressives.org. We'll take your calls after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, I hope a Tea Partier will call in. I really do. If only it was that easy. Filling in for Tom Hartman today, Carl Frisch here all afternoon. Give us a call, toll free, 866-987-TOM. Visit me online at carlfrisch.com. We're taking your calls. Let's go to Robert in Seattle. Hey, Robert.
Yeah, I have, like I said, the perfect way to address the former president.
What's
like
that?
I said, with a, You don't even mention him at all.
Okay.
You simply tie everything that is bad about that sort of economics. You say Republican.
Well, here's the problem with that.
Republican over and over and over again. You say they want to bring back these Republican policies that almost destroyed this country
That's basically what people are doing right now. The problem with that, as I see it, is that, believe it or not, George W. Bush is still much more unpopular than the Republican Party. So people have a much more visceral reaction when they think about these things being the product of Bush. Which they know is a Republican. There's kind of a cognitive dissonance there. But the way that people are talking about it right now is to talk about it as if it's just standard Republican policy. So I'm thinking for something a little bit bolder. Why don't we go to Elizabeth in Marion, Pennsylvania. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi, Carl. How are you?
Good.
I'm so excited to talk to you today. I want to talk to you about Wall Street. So
all right.
I think that Wall Street is really starting to fight back. And I'm worried because I feel like, you know, when you can tell that they've done something wrong because they're screaming about it, but what are the Democrats going to do to make sure that middle-class Americans hear the message that their policies are better for most middle-class Americans?
Well,
I feel like
the problem is one of money right now. I mean, the president raised almost $1 billion last time around. I don't think he'll raise as much money this time. But there will be a lot of money on both sides. And certainly when you hear about Wall Street executives writing checks for millions of dollars to these shady, shadowy super PACs, it gets kind of frightening. And you're right. You know that they're in trouble and that they're worried when they start screaming loudly. They're like the little kid who gets their hand caught in the cookie jar, and then starts screaming and pointing somewhere else, to distract their parent. Unfortunately, that's not going to work for them this time. If we get more candidates out there, we were just talking to Adam Green about Eric Grego and Louis Saldana in California, talking about the need to hold Wall Street accountable. People really do want to do that. It is something that cuts across all party lines. People want to hold corporate America accountable. This is black and white as far as I'm concerned. We can do it and we can win on it. The president has to be brave enough to stand up and say so. Otherwise, it makes it very difficult to do that succeeding. Let's go to Tim in Canastonia, New York. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Carl.
Yes.
Hey, how are you, buddy?
I'm well. What's on your mind?
First, I just want to say one thing about the equal marriage thing.
Yes.
That should be a no-brainer. Except,
should be.
I don't know if you remember the saying from the 60s, you know, make love, not war.
Yeah.
But the Republicans would rather make war, not love, because there's more money in it, and they can just ask Dick Cheney all about that.
Well, I think Republicans are part of the oldest profession, so it's funny you should bring that up. but at the end of the day, you said it should be a no-brainer. Unfortunately, people aren't using their brains to think about this.
Well, you know what? That's been that way for a long time, brother.
That's true. You know, Tina Dupuy has that great piece on her website, tinadupuy.com, where she talks about this just fake reality that sometime in the past was better and sometime in the future is scarier. This country has always been about granting, you know, extending more rights to people in this country, not about going backwards. If we want to go backwards, there's all kinds of things we need to turn back, but it looks like that's what the Republicans want to do anyways. I mean, let's look at the last couple months. They want to get rid of birth control. They want to make it so that, you know, people can't have sex the way they want to have sex in different states. And is it any surprise that they're against gay marriage? I mean, it used to be that people said, Republicans are trying to get into the gay bedrooms and tell them what to do and what not to do. They're trying to get into everybody's bedroom now. I mean, geez Louise, at some point we have to ask them a very frank, you know, maybe we should sit them down and say, Republican Party, we're here because we love you. And your obsession with sex has affected our lives in the following ways. You know, it'd be great to see them on an episode of Intervention. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. Let's go to Gary in Chicago. Hey, Gary.
Well, what you just said about the Republican Party, they have no, you know, hold on morality. You know, Tom often talks about the GOP logo, which is the star flipped over, which
right.
represents Satan representing greed. And so greed is what the Republicans are about. They want to end, you know, regulations, needed regulations, you know,
sure.
all over the place, and the social safety nets, and all for their personal profit. And so that, you know, they can't have a, you know, an issue with morality, them being, you know, were, you know, greed and self.
Well, Gary, don't you think it's kind of like a magician at this point? I mean, they're acting like magicians. You're right about the morality thing, which is what draws into question this hard line against marriage equality for me. On one hand, they're, you know, showing you, you know, we're against gay marriage and everything else. And on the other hand, they're trying to strip away these protections for basic necessities for hardworking men and women. So they're distracting you with the gay marriage while they gut everything else. It's like the oldest trick in the book. I'm surprised they're not putting their positions under a cup in the middle of Central Park.
Well, George Carlin has a good comedy skit on that, you know. He says the GOP, you know, they're against, you know, birth control and all that, but they have no safety nets for the children once they're born. They don't want the mother to have any kind of health insurance. They don't have no insurance for the baby, but yet they want the baby to be born. And the thing is, they want that baby to grow up to be a soldier and end up being a dead soldier.
Well, and Gary, it's not. They do have a safety net. It's called a factory floor. They'd love it if the babies being born to these folks who can't afford them were working in the factories. Let's go to Doug in Denver. Hey, Doug.
Yeah, man. I enjoy Tom, sure. I listen to him all the time. But one thing I really like to address, I wish we changed this so quote-unquote called progressive movement to the token movement, because that's basically how I feel as an African-American when I hear this progressive label that we put on right and wrong. I don't think myself that I lack the intelligence of knowing right and wrong.
Right.
I got a friend in the mental hospital. I go see him, and they always tell me he's progressing. You know, and I don't know why you guys. Well, I kind of know why. It's almost like pimping our pain, but at the same time, this progressive movement is so fundamentally beyond where we are psychologically. It's just an embarrassment.
What do you mean?
You know. You know, you guys, I mean, it's not a hard issue. You know, they have no problem applying what they call justice to the black community. They fill the jails up. Black community know that they're serious about crime. Well, why don't they do it with politicians? Why don't they do it with the...
Because they write the laws.
The local...
you know, you're right. You're right.
Yeah, well...
And
we're sick of it as African Americans.
I think there are a lot
of
people standing beside you that are sick of it. And it's, I mean, just look what happened in Florida with Trayvon Martin. But look at what the reason that the Trayvon Martin story became such a big deal in the media was not because it was Trayvon Martin and the circumstances surrounding it necessarily. It's because that stuff happens all the time in this country and nobody pays attention to it. You nearly have to be a blonde little girl getting kidnapped to get any you know, attention when it comes to crime in this country, and it's quite sad at the end of the day. Let's go to David in St. Paul. Hey, David, you were in Chicago,
I understand. Hey, Carl. I just wanted to mention, you know, I was in Chicago this weekend with the National Nurses United convention.
I hope I am not your first. I hope I'm not your only phone call from jail. You weren't one of the protesters picked up, were you?
No.
Okay, good.
I was in Chicago for the NATO and the National Nurses United protest, and there was a proposal for the nurses are proposing along with other coalitions, are proposing for a Robin Hood tax, which would be a tax on financial transactions on Wall Street.
I think it's a great idea.
It would generate up to $365 billion in the United States alone.
Right. I think it's a good idea, but it's really just a good starting place as far as I'm concerned. Those transactions should be taxed, and wealth that is accumulated through those types of actions should be taxed as income. I think that's pretty simple, and it's easy for people to understand. I mean, look, when you make transactions, you end up paying fees for the people that are making the transactions for you. I don't see why the government shouldn't be getting a piece of that. Thanks for your call. Let's try and fit one more quick one in. Let's go to Jack in Kent, Washington. Hey, Jack.
Hi, Tom.
Really quick.
I'm a great believer in Paul Krugman, and he says in order to get the economy moving, you have to put money into the economy.
Right.
In order to move it, to get people back to work. Now, what the Republicans are doing, they're cutting back on everything, teachers, firemen, policemen, et cetera.
Well, and do you want to know why they're doing that? Just think about what Mitch McConnell said when they won the House of Representatives back. His only goal was to stop this president, Barack Obama, from having a second term. So, you know, if you're a cynic like I am when it comes to the politicians in Washington, it's pretty clear what they're doing. This president, through modest investment with the stimulus, was able to get 4.2 million jobs. We need to do more to get more jobs in this country. We need to stop firing public workers. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and we will be right back.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, today's top stories with the Talk Radio News Service.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit CarlFrisch.com for more information.
Oh, there's nothing I like a little bit of Roxy music. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom all afternoon. I'm Carl Frisch. Thanks for sticking around with us. We're taking your calls. I've been asking people to give me either words that we can use when talking about the last president, since we're not allowed to mention George W. Bush's name. It's something about Beetlejuice. I guess you mentioned it three times, and we get transported back to the last presidency. But I want suggestions. What can we call him since we can't say his name? And furthermore, do you have a title for his book? He's coming out with a book on how to fix the economy this fall. We're not sure yet. We're still trying to confirm whether or not it's a coloring book. But it is, in fact, a book. So give us a call toll-free, 866-987-8466, with your suggestions. Up that way, we've got Carla in Pueblo, Colorado. Carla, you have a name for President Bush.
Well, I would call him – hi, Carl. How are you?
Hello.
I would call him the puppet of the Royal Oil War Mongers.
The problem with that one, it's a little tongue-tying. It's kind of like the rural juror. The rural juror. So let's go back to the drawing board on that and call in with your other suggestions. Joining me now to talk about today's top stories is Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service. Good afternoon, Victoria.
Oh, I'm great. Thanks. How are you?
Great. What's going on today?
President Obama today, along with leaders of America's NATO allies, made an agreement, and that was to hand over the primary role in providing security in Afghanistan to the Afghans themselves, starting next summer. So that's going to be the beginning of the end of the U.S. involvement in the war, which, of course, has gone on for 10 years. They say
right.
The transition is irreversible.
Well, and, you know, Mitt Romney will probably claim credit for this like he did with the GM bailout, but...
Who knows? Who knows? He was pretty critical of the president's foreign policy in an op-ed over the weekend. The president said, well, our forces broke the Taliban's momentum. Today, we can agree on NATO's long-term relationship with Afghanistan beyond 2014, including our support of Afghan security forces. He also said, we have a lot of work to do. And I should also mention that one thing that I think has been widely misreported that he said after his meeting with President Karzai, many outlets are reporting that he said the Afghan war as we understand it is over, as though he's saying sort of mission accomplished. It's slightly out of context. What he actually said was, even if you put it slightly in context, was part of the sentence was, and also painting a vision post 2014 in which we have ended our combat role, the Afghan war as we understand it is over.
Well, you know, all he has to do is open his mouth to be taken out of context by some figures in the media.
Indeed. Indeed. That is absolutely correct. Also today, Representative Peter King, who's the chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, called for a formal investigation into leaks of classified information regarding the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula underwear bomb plot that was recently uncovered. He said it's essential to find out who did it. It was a dramatic mission and a terrible, terrible leak. He's requesting the FBI conduct a full inquiry, and he wants the investigation to include the intelligence community, the Department of Defense, Homeland Security, law enforcement, and the White House, including the National Security Staff.
Well, Peter King is nothing if not wanting investigations anytime he can. What are the likelihood that this is going to happen before the elections? Any idea?
Apparently, the FBI has already started a preliminary investigation. I think this is going to happen.
All right.
I think it's going to happen. Also today, Notre Dame University joined other Catholic institutions in suing the Obama administration over its contraceptive mandate. The lawsuit argues that the mandate and the health care law requiring that insurance plans cover birth control for women without a copay violates the religious freedom of Catholic institutions.
Well, and here's my question on that front. Many of these universities already cover contraception for their married employees or for their employees in general. Why the big stink now?
They say that, and this is what Timothy Dolan, the Cardinal Archbishop of New York, says. We've tried negotiation with the administration and legislation with the Congress, and we'll keep at it, but there's still no fix. Time is running out, and our valuable ministries and fundamental rights hang in the balance, so we have to resort to the courts now.
Well, their form of deal-making is much like the Republicans. Give us everything we want, and we'll stop complaining.
That is what you want in a lawsuit, isn't it?
Yeah.
Most definitely that's what you want in a lawsuit. Also, the ex-Rutgers student who was convicted of bias crimes for spying on his gay roommate was sentenced today to 30 days in jail in a case that drew international attention. He could have got 10 years in prison, and he still could be deported to his native India for his conviction of invasion of privacy and bias intimidation. He used a webcam,
right,
stream video of his roommate and another man during a sexual encounter in their dorm room in September 2010.
Right. Well, and he watched it for who knows how long with another classmate as his roommate was making out with a guy, essentially, and embarrassed him, and eventually his roommate committed suicide. I thought 10 years and deportation was a bit much in this regard. This kid is not anti-gay, but 30 days is, in my book, ridiculous. It's such a slap on the wrist.
It's really become very interesting because a number of the gay rights activists who at the beginning were calling for very harsh sentences now are saying that, if anything, he should get a light sentence or perhaps not, no sentence at all, because they say that this was not a hate crime, as you just said, but they feel that he was just one of the many people who contributed to this young man's suicide.
Right. Well, it's certainly an interesting day out there. I anticipate that this, screwing with the president's words over Afghanistan is going to be leading the evening cable chatter. As the right, mixes it around and the left is forced to respond instead of talking about substance here. And that's unfortunate. But I want to thank you, Victoria Jones, for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Alrighty. Up next, more great chat with some interesting people. We'll be talking to Jeremy Davis from the Stonewall Democrats.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. This is Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. Some news that broke over the weekend, and this is pretty great stuff here. The NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, has released a resolution supporting marriage equality. At a meeting of the 103-year-old Civil Rights Group's Board of Directors, the organization voted to support marriage equality as a continuation of its historic commitment to equal protection under the law. I couldn't think of anybody else to talk about this with and delve into some other subjects as well. Then Jeremy Davis, he is the executive director of Stonewall Democrats. It's an organization of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender Democrats that seeks to support candidates who support LGBT equality. Jeremy, thanks for joining me.
Absolutely. Glad to be here, Carl. Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of this news?
I think it's great news. You know, there's been a lot of question about whether or not African-Americans would support the president after his announcement in support of the freedom to marry, and with the nation's largest association of African-Americans coming out in support of marriage and so strongly and so forcefully, it's just fantastic news for our movement.
Meanwhile, Mitt Romney, the Republican nominee for president, is devolving on marriage. And even basic protections for LGBT people. Just to reiterate the point, in 2004, when George Bush was pursuing a federal marriage amendment to deny LGBT people equality under the law, he came out and endorsed civil unions for LGBT people. And Mitt Romney, not only does he not support marriage equality, but he doesn't even support civil unions. And some could make the argument he doesn't even support domestic partnerships or legal contracts between same-sex couples.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. You know, Mitt Romney is devolving while the president is evolving. You know, I kind of like to think of the GOP at this point kind of like the Romney station wagon, and the LGBT community is poor Seamus up on the roof.
Oh, that's mean, because he wouldn't even give us a ride, frankly.
Yeah, that's probably true.
You know, he'd leave it up to the states as to whether or not gay people are allowed to be in vehicles.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
So NAACP now backs marriage equality. At a certain point, and, you know, the argument, you know, those NOM documents, for example, the National Organization of Marriage, for Marriage, whatever, Maggie Gallagher's old outfit, they had those documents, internal documents that were leaked and reported on Huffington Post and elsewhere, where they were trying to divide the LGBT community and the African-American community and Latino community. What do you think this does to that, this announcement by the NAACP that it backs marriage equality?
Well, it certainly puts the lie to their claim that the president is going to lose the African-American community by and large by his announcement.
Hey, if they think that, more power to them. It ain't going to happen.
It's just not going to happen. You know, I was on about a week ago with Brian Brown, and he was saying, you know, the president has lost the African-American community with this, and he's going to lose re-election. And I'm just not seeing it. The polling isn't showing that the president has lost a lot of support because of this. And honestly, I think anyone who was going to vote against the president for his position on marriage equality was already voting against him anyway.
Right. And if anything, this puts some excitement into some base pieces that the Obama campaign needs to turn out, primarily young people and women.
Yes, young people, women. You know, I'm hearing just as much from, you know, the straight community as the LGBT community of how excited and energized they are because, you know, this, as, you know, president of the NAACP, Ben Jealous, said when they made this announcement, this is the biggest, you know, civil rights issue of our time. And, you know, to have the president come out just as the country has a bare majority in support of marriage equality is a bold step. It's a very progressive step, and it's really energized the left of his base.
Well, and you know, one group of people that has been driven absolutely batty and into utter confusion by this are gay Republicans. Now, I was once a Republican, but I was not out when I was a Republican.
I'll hold that against you.
Well, everybody experiments in their youth. I mean, with being a Republican, I did in that regard. I'm curious, you know, when he first announced it, when Obama first came forward and said that he supported marriage equality, the log cabin Republicans, which are the sane gay Republicans or more sane gay Republicans as compared to the Go Proud folks, put out statements saying it was too little, too late, and you know, it was just politics. What do you think that they, how do you think they look at this shaping up going into November where their nominee once again holds firmly and tightly to archaic anti-gay positions?
They're in a pretty sticky wicket, aren't they? You know,
to use Mitt Romney's favorite metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of sad for them. You know, I was rather outraged when I saw their statement blasting the president when, you know, Mitt Romney had reaffirmed his position not only against marriage equality, but as you said, against civil unions.
Well, it was remarkably hypocritical, too, because, you know, log cabin Republicans, LGBT Republicans, whenever one of their politicians steps forward and says something even moderately pro-gay, the left, the rest of the country is told to keep it down and not chastise those people for not being forward-thinking enough, because, you know, we just have to get them there somehow. Right. As if a Republican announcing that, sure, gay people should be allowed to eat and buy food, as if, you know, statements like those shouldn't be held up for ridicule.
Right. Well, you know, what's interesting, too, is in 2008, log cabin Republicans ran ads against Mitt Romney. You can find them on YouTube. You know, they ran television ads and radio ads blasting Mitt Romney for being a flip-flopper. They withheld endorsement from him. And strangely enough, in 2004, when George Bush ran for re-election, they withheld their endorsement from him because he supported a federal marriage amendment. And yet now they're going to flirt with the idea of actually endorsing Mitt Romney. I know that Clark Cooper put out an editorial, what was it, last week, that said, you know, Mitt Romney was in danger of not getting their support or whatever. But you
to
know,
which Mitt Romney replied, okay.
Oh, yeah. What does Mitt Romney care? He already didn't have their support. You know, I mean, the problem for Log Cabin right now is their executive director, Clark Cooper, sits on the finance committee for the RNC. So,
well, and he was also raising money for Speaker Boehner, who's, you know, right, putting millions of dollars in the legal fight to protect the so-called Defense of Marriage Act.
Right. It's a rather hypocritical position, if you ask me.
Well, it's extremely hypocritical, but I understand where this outrage comes from, if you think about it. You've been in this fight, you know, as a Stonewall Dem for quite some time, and I'm sure in virtually every debate leading up to the president's announcement, the gay Republican, insert name here, on the other side of the table from you, has always said, look, he has the same views on marriage that the president does.
Right.
And now they don't have that argument anymore.
No,
so what
don't.
Do they get to do?
No, I don't know what they're going to do. I mean, obviously they're going to take a different tack, and they're going to double down on bigotry, apparently. That's what Mitt Romney did.
Well, it wouldn't be surprising. I mean, if we expect nothing less from Mitt Romney, in my opinion, Mitt Romney really used the LGBT community coming out of Massachusetts as the one issue that he could use to just whip the conservative base in line by saying, look, no, I hate gay people. I really do. I'm even willing to fire them. Jeremy, do you have time to stick around for the next segment?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. We're talking to Jeremy Davis. He's the executive director of Stonewall Democrats, which you can find at stonewalldemocrats.org. It's a great group, and you should check them out online and sign up for their email list so you can find out more about what they're up to. Jeremy's a good friend of mine here in Washington. And I'm interested to know where gay Republicans go from here. And this fight over marriage equality, if the president's now on board and the NAACP is now on board, what's next? Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, more about why gay Republicans are having their feelings hurt by Mitt Romney. Unrequited love? Welcome back. It's Monday, and it is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch all afternoon. It is 20 after. Are you a Republican? Are you listless? Do gay people make you uncomfortable? When you see gay people, do you worry about your own marriage? Give us a call. Let's talk about it. I'm sure I can help you iron out those issues. I'm not even a woman, and I can use an iron. If that doesn't blow your mind, maybe our conversation will. Give us a call. Toll free, 866-987-TOM. Republicans go right to the front of the line. I want to talk about this with you. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Jeremy Davis. He is the executive director of Stonewall Democrats, about this news that the NAACP has followed President Obama's lead and come out in support of marriage equality, and the weird position it puts these log cabin Republicans in. I hesitate to use this metaphor, Jeremy, but I imagine that gay Republicans feel like they're at a frat party staring at one of the frat guys against another wall. Maybe they've had five or six beers And even though they know that the frat guy is not gay, in this case, frat guy will be Mitt Romney, they don't care that they have this unrequited crush because they don't get love from anybody in their party, so what's one more person?
Yeah, you know, and the question is what's Mitt Romney going to do? You know, you look at him and he's kind of standing there shifting uncomfortably, kind of winks a couple times, but then,
can you blame him? I mean, he had never heard of a homosexual fellow as late as the 1960s.
Right, but you know, then in the 90s, he was telling Log Cabin Republicans that he was going to be better on LGBT issues than Mitt Romney. I mean, than Teddy Kennedy.
Well, in fairness, he has been better on LGBT issues than Mitt Romney in the past.
This is true. I guess Mitt Romney is better on LGBT issues than Mitt Romney. He's
but that's an interesting point. I mean, it's mentioned often that he, when he was running for Senate against Ted Kennedy, he said that he would be better for LGBT people than Ted Kennedy. Let's run down the list. The Employment Non-Discrimination Act at a federal level, Mitt Romney doesn't support it, does he?
No.
He doesn't support marriage equality?
Nope.
He doesn't even believe the state should be able to provide marriage equality?
Not at all.
He doesn't support civil unions, which is basically, we just won't call it marriage, but we'll give gay people the same rights.
Right.
Not even at the state level.
Right.
He says, and this is what always gives the kicker, by the time you whittle it down, he'll say something like, look, I think we should treat them with dignity and respect, them being gay people.
Yeah.
In fact, I'd be willing to let them visit each other in the hospital. Although he wouldn't allow for a federal law to force that on all the states.
Yeah.
So
only partial dignity and respect.
Is it a stretch of the imagination to conclude that it's a good thing the president signed hate crimes because this kind of thinking leads to more gay hate? And at least in some places, if you're lucky enough to live in them, Mitt Romney will let you visit your partner in the hospital.
it really kind of does lead to more hate. I mean, this kind of doubling down on bigotry. I mean, you know, look at Mitt Romney's position, and yet one of the most evil Republicans in the land, Dick Cheney, supports marriage equality. He supports, you know, the full panoply of rights for LGBT people. Well, maybe not the T, but at least gay and lesbian folks, since he has a lesbian daughter. And yet Mitt Romney can't even bring himself to support any sort of relationship
anything.
Recognition.
But, you know, be fair, Jeremy. He says we deserve dignity and respect.
But what
just not from our government.
Is there in saying that your relationship is equal?
Right. And this is the ridiculous thing. I would love one member of the media traveling, covering his campaign, when he says, look, we can differ, we can disagree on marriage equality. I think gay people should be treated with dignity and respect. I would like one reporter to say, okay, that's all fine and good, Governor. What should the government do to show that they have dignity and respect for gay and lesbian people?
Well, my understanding is the media got so bad last week, he stopped taking media requests anyway.
Surprise, surprise. It's what he did during the primary.
Yeah.
Well,
now the primary is all but over.
Well,
going to hiding.
And is there any chance? I mean, maybe the log cabins are holding out for a better VP pick, but it doesn't make any political sense for him to pick somebody who's moderate, does it?
Are there any moderates left in the GOP?
I'm sure there's like a state senator in Maine or something.
I mean, they're either forcing them out or they're retiring on their own. So I think it's going to be difficult for him to find a moderate. But
well, I mean, there's a handful of Republicans in the House, for example, that support LGBT equality. They're not going to be on his short list, are they?
No, probably not.
There'll be no Congressman Hanna from New York. There'll be no Ileana Ross Layton from Florida.
Right.
Those people are ignored when it comes to these issues by their own party.
They are.
So it's going to be somebody conservative, because if you think about it, everybody complains within the Republican Party about his weakness with the base. Therefore, it has to be somebody just as conservative, if not more, with better credentials than he is.
Right. Because he has to prove himself. He has to prove himself a conservative. I mean, he just went to, you know, the altar of hate, as I like to call it, at Liberty University. You know, last week,
where they believe his religion is a cult, by the way.
Yeah, he's so desperate to win over the right that he's willing to go and speak at a university that teaches its students that his religion is a cult and not a valid religion.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And remember, this is a university that kicked the college Democratic Club off campus because they supported LGBT rights.
Right.
It really is quite sad. So if you could give one message to gay Republicans sitting at home, what would it be?
Vote for Barack Obama. He actually supports your rights.
Well, and isn't that, at the end of the day, what really matters here? Isn't it a fact that Obama is more likely to compromise on issues that are important to Republicans than Republicans and Mitt Romney are to compromise on LGBT equality?
I think that's definitely shown. I mean, you know, back in my home state of Indiana, there's a Republican running for Senate, Richard Murdoch, who said his idea of bipartisanship is when the Democrat votes for his idea.
Well, that's George Bush's, I mean, the president whose name shall not be spoken's version of compromise as well. Jeremy Davis, Stonewall Democrats, thanks for joining me.
Absolutely.
Go sign up for their email list. Go to stonewalldemocrats.org, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, my good friend Bill Press from The Bill Press Show. Stick around. Welcome back. Good afternoon. It's 34 after. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom, and all afternoon, I am Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com or follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. I got to tell you, it's been a fascinating show. And joining me now to talk about 2012 and what is happening out there. I don't know if you know this, but Mitt Romney still doesn't have enough delegates to cinch up the Republican nomination. That is pathetic. Anyways, joining me now to talk about this and everything else happening in 2012 is my good friend, Bill Press, host of the nationally syndicated Bill Press Show, which you can watch every morning, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time on Current TV. More details at current.com/Bill Press. And the author of one of my favorite books of the year, The Obama Hate Machine. Bill Press, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Carl, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Bill?
Hey, you're on a roll. Good to talk to you.
Well, your show starts at 6 a.m. I imagine you're getting ready for bed.
I just had my afternoon nap, so I'm ready to go on to start all over again.
Well, I'm watching 2012. What do you make of, you know, the first thing I thought when I saw what Cory Booker said on Meet the Press,
yeah.
I thought, what a bane in the arse.
Good for you. First of all, look, I really like Cory Booker, but, you know, this is not the first time he's gone off the reservation, right? He's like Chris Christie's best friend when it comes
right.
Yeah, when it comes to education. I mean, they had that big deal together, and I mean, the teachers were outraged at Cory Booker because, you know, Chris Christie declared war on teachers and public employees.
Right.
And Booker backed him up. So, you know, that was the first time I thought, what is this guy? Now, you know, if I lived alongside of him and my house were on fire, I would want him as my neighbor, right?
Right.
But I don't want him out there talking and fronting for the Obama campaign. He is dead wrong on this Bain Capital. Look, you know, why are we talking about Bain Capital? Because Mitt Romney talks about Bain Capital.
Right. And they're not sure how they talk about it.
Yeah.
I mean, if you listen to Eric Fernstrom, he was on MSNBC this afternoon on Andrea Mitchell's good show over there. And he said, this is old news. Why are we talking about Bain?
Yeah, well, tell Mitt Romney that. Yeah, right? Mitt Romney's whole campaign is, the economy's broken. I can fix it because I'm a businessman. Look at my record. Right?
He won't even talk about being governor of Massachusetts when it comes to jobs because his state was so poor.
Right.
The only states that did worse in job creation were hit by Hurricane Katrina.
Right. So he talks about Bain. He brags about Bain. He says, Bain is where I prove that I can create jobs. So it's perfectly, perfectly logical and fair to take a look at Bain and see what their record really is. And what, you know, what was his name? Steve, the guy on that other morning show.
Yeah.
Ratner, right? Said
right.
last week, you know, we shouldn't talk about creating jobs at Bain because that's not what it was all about. They were there to create wealth, not jobs. Duh.
Right. And that's precisely what they did. One thing that's remarkable to me when it comes to Bain is when we're talking about giving credit. So, you know, The Romney campaign for months said that he created hundreds of 100,000 jobs when he was at Bain, which they've now started saying, well, some of their people have started saying just thousands. It just depends on who you're listening to. But they're giving that number includes all the jobs at all of the companies since that were acquired when Mitt Romney was there, even those since he left.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet they're attacking the Obama administration for mentioning that one of the companies that was acquired when Mitt Romney was running Bain, that they loaded with debt and forced into bankruptcy, that was forced to go bankrupt years later and fire hundreds of people. Well, that happened after Mitt Romney left.
Look, these guys, they know that they're on, I think, a very weak foundation in running on Bain. So they want to talk about it, but it's unfair to anybody else to talk about it. Well, it was okay for Teddy Kennedy in 94, and it's okay for Barack Obama in 2012. And if Cory Booker doesn't like it, you know.
I mean, somebody's got to get over there and fix his flat tire. I don't know. Maybe he had a car problem on the way.
I kind of feel it's been fixed.
Axelrod was right there with the jack when he was needed, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
that was crazy. And then Marco Rubio, I'm sure you talked about that.
Oh, yeah.
Obama, the most divisive figure in modern American history. Give me a break.
Right.
How about George Bush, right?
Well, you're not allowed to, Bill, we've been talking about this all show. You're no longer allowed to mention George W. Bush.
Oh, really?
He's like Beetlejuice. You say his name three times, he gets to be president again.
Well, Mitt Romney doesn't want us to mention his name. That's right. Mitt Romney never does, right?
Well, and that's the interesting thing. I don't know if you've heard this yet, but George W. Bush is coming out with a book this fall about how to fix the economy. This is not a joke.
No. I read that. Yeah.
And I have confirmed that it is not, and I repeat, I've been trying to get this clear all day, it is not a coloring book.
It's not a comic book?
It's not a comic book. It's not a coloring book. It doesn't have one pop-up figure.
Is it coming out next April 1st?
Well, I mean, I was picturing that you'd go into a bookstore and open it up and be one of those fake books that doesn't have anything on any of the pages. But
yeah, I got a great idea. How to fix the economy, right? Let's launch two wars, give billionaires a tax cut, and then expand Medicare and pay for none of it.
Right. Well, it's perfect economic sense. I mean, if Obama hadn't just ruined it retroactively into the Bush administration. I'm wondering what Romney's going to say when the book comes out. Is he going to even have a chance to read it, or is he just going to talk really, you know, blandly, like, oh, the book is just the right number of pages. The trees are just the right height.
That's how he judges his books.
So
he does his estates by the height of the trees and his book by how many pages they have.
Right. I think Romney will at some point
has 200 pages.
Come out and say that he doesn't know how to read. And then the next week talk about reading Chaucer.
I'm telling you, you know, people like you and me, Carl, we could not make this stuff up.
No, and yet it's still close, which is why we cannot rest on our laurels. We keep mentioning George W. Bush because, A, it's funny, and, B, it's you know, frightening. I mean, remember what we said about George W. Bush in 2000. Mitt Romney could still get elected, and that's not something we want to do.
It is scary when, I mean, I gave a talk in Santa Barbara Saturday morning, and you would think, this is a big group of their business leaders, but they're all Democrats, right? I mean, you would think based on what he's done,
right,
and based on what a poor candidate Mitt Romney is, that Obama would be like 20 points ahead, right?
Right.
And he's 2 points ahead in the latest Real Clear Politics poll. I mean, you know, they're averaging out 46 to 44.
Right.
I mean, that's frightening.
Well, I think one of the reasons is that there is real, I mean, people are still hurting out there, let's be honest.
Yep.
It hasn't gone quick enough, and mostly because the Republicans wouldn't let Obama do what he needed to do.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
I guarantee you, if the president is reelected, here's willing, and things continue at the same pace, I mean, we will be looking at, you know, nearing 6% unemployment, which is much better than where he started. You know, we'll be talking about 10 million more people, you know, 10 million people at work, if not more. People will be clamoring for a third term if things continue in the trajectory that they're going.
I believe that the unemployment is going to be down maybe 7.8%, you know, by by the end of October. And
right.
The problem for Mitt Romney is, of course, I mean, that's the last thing he wants, right? I mean, they want gloom and doom. They want the economy to fail.
Which is why they've not been willing to do anything in Washington.
Totally. Totally. No, that's why the Republicans have shot down every jobs bill, because a jobs bill means good news for the economy, good news for Obama. No, that, look at what, you know, Mitch McConnell has said. That's still his driving purpose.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's be clear. Mitch McConnell said just after Republicans won the House of Representatives back in 2010, he said his number one goal was to deny Obama a second term.
I have to tell you, Carl, he said that in January 2009.
Oh.
That was at the beginning of the Obama administration, not after John Boehner took over.
You mean they didn't give him a fair shake?
Not even for the first 2 years, right?
Not even the first 100 days, that's for sure. I mean, the curious thing for me is Democrats have never behaved this way when they've been in the minority. Think of all the things that they compromised on during the Bush administration.
Are you kidding? No.
The tax cuts, the No Child Left Behind, all Medicare Part D not being paid for.
Oh, no, absolutely.
The wars.
But you're touching on one of my pet peeves, right? Is Democrats are always too damn nice.
Well, they want to legislate, right? They come into Washington wanting to make laws. And if they can be a part of something to make it better than what it was going to be, they see that as their job. Republicans go to Washington to do nothing because they don't believe the government should do anything other than hand wealth to corporate America and the extremely wealthy.
No, and Democrats say, oh, well, we fought hard, but we lost. Now let's see what we can do, right, for the good of the country.
Right.
Republicans, we lost, but screw you, right? We're going to make sure you don't get anything done, and then we're going to come back and kill you the next time around. And you know who started it? Newt Gingrich. It's
right.
A perpetual campaign. And if you talk to people in Congress who were there then and they are now still there now, it all changed with Newt Gingrich, who put out, remember that famously, that list of names. Here are the words you use when you're talking about Democrats, right? Like lazy, traitor.
Or not even calling it the Democratic Party, just calling it the Democrat Party.
Democrat Party, right.
Bill, can you stick around for the next segment?
Sure, love to.
I want to chat a bit more. I mean, one thing that's really great that's happened in 2012 is that Republicans got to know the Newt Gingrich that Democrats hate. So we've always got that going for us. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Bill Press. He's the host of Current TV's Full Court Press, which is a simulcast of his radio show in the morning, The Bill Press Show. You can find that at BillPressShow.com. And it's on from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern. We'll be back with more from Bill Press after this.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, Bill Press has more on Mitt Romney.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit CarlFrisch.com for more information.
Welcome back. It's the Bill Press Show. It is 50 after, just 10 minutes till the bottom of the hour. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. It's been a delight to be with you all afternoon. More about me at carlfrisch.com. This is the Tom Hartman Program, of course. You can also follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Bill Press, host of the Bill Press Show, and my good friend. Bill, thanks for sticking around.
Hey, glad to do it, and you forgot to say that you are often and I'm so happy to have you there, an in-studio guest.
That's true.
On Current TV
on
all of our local.
How is that going? I understand the ratings are up big time from when the show started.
The ratings are colossal from when the show started, but of course, you have to recognize that there was nothing there before.
I suppose that, Bill, that's
so
not,
easy to beat.
You're not, I was trying to help spin for you. So
I'm too honest for that.
What, you know, this Bush coloring book that's coming out about fixing the economy, is this just more of the, you know, fix the reputation or rewrite history of the Bush years?
Oh, sure, sure. And, you know, they all try to do it. I must admit, I'm reading a wonderful book now called The President's Club, right? And there are very few members of the President's Club.
Right.
But one thing they all have in common And so many of them, I mean, look at Nixon, look at Carter, right? I mean, look at George W. Bush, look at Gerry Ford, either thrown out or impeached, right? Or forced to resign or whatever. Not all of them walked away with their head held high out of Washington, but they all, they hunkered down for a little bit like Bush is doing. It doesn't take that long. And then they try to rehabilitate themselves, right, and to right the wrong impression. They think the wrong impression. So we can't let them get away with it. We got to keep reminding.
All right. So this is kind of like,
really like
this is kind of like after a first date. So we've just had our first date with George Bush. How long is he supposed to wait before he calls us? Because it doesn't seem like he's waited nearly long enough.
I would say never call again. Right.
Right.
I don't even 10 years is not long enough.
What about a text message saying that it just didn't work out?
If he would say that, you know, I must admit, unlike Dick Cheney, right, he has been, I think he's behaved himself pretty well, meaning he stayed out of sight. Right.
Right.
Unlike Cheney, who was always in your face and openly criticizing President
from
Obama.
From virtually day one.
From day one.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, and Bush didn't do that. But this book, I mean, the idea that, I'll tell you what it means, though, Carl, is remember one of Romney's people said, When one reporter said, well, you know, yeah, you don't like Bush, I mean, Obama's policies on the economy. What are yours? And they said, well, it's basically going to be the same, the Bush policies on steroids.
Right.
So this book.
That's right.
Out,
they've said that they want to do what Bush did on illegal performance-enhancing drugs.
Perfectly. Right. So I think this book coming out is part of that master plan. I don't think it's any
well,
accident.
Well, you know, a better book worth reading is The Obama Hate Machine, which you can get at BillPressShow.com. I want to thank you for joining us, and folks should tune in tomorrow on Current at 6 a.m. Eastern Time for your great show.
Yeah, what the hell? Get up early, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I've got to get up early, so do you.
I'm running on a treadmill, my bed, but I'm watching in the morning, that's for sure. Bill, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Carl. See you.
All righty. This is the Bill Press. I did it again. I talked to Bill Press, I think Bill Press Show. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today. I'm Carl Frisch, and we're taking your calls. Let's go to Ron in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Ron.
Carl.
Yes.
Nice to see your face on TV.
Thank you.
I'm calling in regards to all these people that are fighting against gay marriage.
Yes.
I am a 62-year-old white heterosexual male. That thinks that
I won't hold that against you.
I appreciate that.
What you do in the privacy of your own home is up to you. Just don't put it in my face.
I'm a little bit pissed off at these people who are fighting against gay marriage.
Right.
That think that they shouldn't have to suffer the same degradation, mental, physical, monetary degradation that we straights do.
Well, I mean, they should at least have the opportunity to. People always say it's, you know, marriage equality, it's the right of marriage, sure, but it's also the responsibility of marriage, right? It's everything that comes along
absolutely.
With it. Whether that's.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Whether that's, you know, ending in divorce or whatever. I will tell you, particularly for my Southern conservative evangelicals who are opposed to LGBT equality and in particular marriage equality, that you want to know what region of the country has the highest divorce rates? The South. You want to know what state has the lowest divorce rate and the highest number of new marriages? Massachusetts, which happens to be the state that first legalized gay marriage and where it's been on the books for almost exactly 8 years. So you've got that going for you. Let's go to Ron. We just had Ron, but let's go to Bill in Greensboro Bend, Vermont. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Carl, how we doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Bill?
All right. Nice. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I've got a name for the fictional. I don't know if they have a fictional coloring book.
Yes.
I've never heard of one. Have you?
No. No, I haven't.
Well, I've got a good name, How Not to Color a Country. And
that's
it
good.
Is written by It, the Ignorant Texan.
Well, you've got to narrow it down for me. I'm just kidding. Thanks.
No, that's a good name. That's short IT by It.
That's
and
true.
People will say, what's
ignorant
it?
Terrestrial. That's right. Thanks, Bill. Let's take one more quick call, if we could. Let's take Angelo in Cottage Grove, Oregon. Hey, Angelo, what's on your mind?
I got a title possibly for his book.
Yes.
And it kind of goes like this. It would be
How to Be a Rich Man's Son and Save My Economy.
Well, it certainly sounds like the life, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Angelo. It's been a pleasure filling in for Tom today on the Tom Hartman Program. For more about me and what I'm up to in terms of my writing and the other media appearances I do, go to carlfrisch.com and sign up for my email list. I want to thank Tom Hartman and Louise and all the great team here on Tom's show. They are tremendously large shoes to fill, and they make it much easier than it could ever be. So thanks a lot, and we'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.